Look at me. Look at me, teacher. Look.
You think I'm crazy? Huh? Is that what he told you? Well, listen up! There is a storm coming! Like nothing you have ever seen! And not a one of you is prepared for it!
Sleep well in your beds. Because if this thing comes true, there ain't gonna be any more.
It's an elevator. Somebody sent those dead up here to get us. Now, there's no controls inside, but there's maintenance overrides in there. I think I can get it to go down.
Do we want to go down?
Where else are we going to go?
Well, it's too bad that you couldn't help your little friend. That little girl. What was her name again? Rue? Yeah, well, we killed her. And now, we're gonna kill you.
You don't understand. You don't know. This place isn't what we thought it was. They aren't what we thought they were. I was wrong. We were so wrong. We must leave.
Once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how are you? I tricked you, because usually I go in the state of New York.
Motherfucker, I'm second! What the hell's going on here?
You've been demoted.
Fuck and no, I'm the Abe. This is Mike.
All right. And well, first off, this is recorded on March 26th, Thursday, 2015. And
we're going to be talking about a contest winner from July 2014.
Maybe not. But first off, Eric.
Wait, wasn't this last fall?
I don't remember.
Okay.
And Eric, by the way, what's Mike got me all flustered. I need to redo this again. So, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Ascancity Podcast. That's Ascancity. You can find it on the iTunes Store and at Ascancity.com. Last episode, episode 193, we had a friend of Dark Discussions, MJ Preston, on the show to talk about his new book, Acadia Event. So I recommend, I normally may or may not recommend Ascancity to people who listen to the show, depending on their taste, but I think listeners of this show in particular would be interested in episode 193.
Yep, and I'm still chugging through it. I don't have as much time to read as I'm similar to you, Mike, where I just got too many things going on, that but I got to chug through the rest of the book. So far, I've read a quarter of the book, and it's really good, absolutely. So you can buy it on Amazon. Mike, you do a genre book.
Yeah, that's Unnatural Selections. It's www.unnaturalselections.com, where I just, again, discuss whatever happens pop in my mind when the opportunity avails. Oddly enough, I've also been invited to, in something completely unrelated, I've been invited to write occasionally on a New York Yankees blog, Bleeding Yankee Blue, so I may end up doing a piece or two for them.
Oh, very good. That's kind of cool. Also, Mike, speaking of articles that you write, posted on the front page of www.darkdiscussions.com is your 2014 personal list of best horror and best genre films and how you decided, and a little blurbs on each of the films. So people can go to darkdiscussions.com, and right on the front page is a link to the story. And if you're listening to this 2 years later because you are just found our podcast, you can go to the articles pull-down menu, and it will be there as well. So, Mike, why don't you let folks know a little bit about that article?
I think you kind of just described it. It's kind of a lot of what I talked about on this when we did our – year in review, and it was just my thought process on how I selected which films, why I picked the films that I picked, and my thoughts on the year. And it's, you know, reiterating an awful lot of what we probably said in the podcast. And I remember, because I wrote it back in January, so I don't really remember a whole lot about what I wrote anymore. But nothing seemed terribly original at the time I was writing it. But it's, yeah, it was why I picked what I picked for the 2014 list and what I thought about the year that we had just left behind.
Yep, very good. And everybody should go check that article out. I did post a link of it on Facebook, but under the Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group. But everybody can just go to www.darkdiscussions.com. And Abe, you do a genre blog?
Yeah, it's called A Regular Movie Reviewer. It's a multi-genre blog where I look at films, TV shows, games, and everything awesome, often from the internet. You can find a link to it on the right side of the Dark Discussions main page, and I have articles scattered throughout the Facebook page as well.
Excellent. Very good. Any other news anybody wanted to mention before we discuss maybe some of the things that we've seen?
Well, the news that I'm fairly ambivalent about, The X-Files is back.
Yeah, I'm pretty ambivalent about that one myself.
Explain.
Started?
On one hand, X-Files. Yay! On the other hand, it's been how long?
Now, explain, because Abe doesn't know what we're talking about. I'm
okay, but Abe, back when you were in diapers, there was a TV series.
We did discuss it.
All right, well, explain it for the listeners.
Right. Well, back when Abe was a child, there was a TV series on Fox called The X-Files that starred the guy from Californication and the shrink from Hannibal, and it started out really good, and then it ended kind of crappy, and they're trying to cash in on bringing it back, and even though the actors walked away, were really happy to walk away from it the first time, but suddenly they're really happy to be coming back and doing it again.
Money.
And, yeah, that's sort of the Leonard Nimoy syndrome. I am not Spock. I am not Spock. I am
out of work.
I'm out of work. I need a paycheck. Fuck yeah, I'll be Spock again. Come on. Can I direct this time? All right, then I'm definitely Spock.
Well, I have to say that I don't think Gillian Anderson wanted to walk away. I think it all just started collapsing because their company wanted more money and they wouldn't give it to him, and then he bailed. And then Gillian Anderson just, you know, the show just started not being as good, because one of the reasons it was good is the playoff of the two main leads, and one of the leads had left the show. And I don't think Anderson necessarily wanted to originally leave, but that's just my guess, right?
I think it's also, you know, to be fair, they did it for 9 years. And especially if you're an actor, you generally want to be an actor because you like performing. And If you really are an actor that has the chops, and I think Duchovny and Anderson do, you don't want to do the same thing for 9 years, for 22 episodes a year, which is, you know, usually, 30 weeks or so of filming that they're doing that. And so I understand that you want to maybe take a break and get some refresher. And really, the writing wasn't up to par. They started repeating themselves, and it was clear that Chris Carter had no clue what he was doing. My question is, What are they going to do? That's something like a 6-episode miniseries. Is it going to be 6 more episodes of aliens and black ooze and bees and clones and colonies and all this stuff that they didn't know what the hell they were doing the first time? Is it 6 episodes of leech people and, you know, and tombs and all this others, or, you know, the standalone episodes? What's the format going to be? You know, and is it going to be sort of, fresh? Are you going to be able to watch it without having rewatched the 9 seasons previously? Or are you going to be able to, you know, sort of jump into this fresh? And if so, are we going to find out what the hell these two characters have been doing?
Well, I got to say, if they try and do this and just ignore the mythology they spent 9 years setting up the first time, I'm going to be highly annoyed.
They did, but they didn't set up the mythology. They sort of threw it at the wall and let it hang there. And
I don't know. There's some stuff that's consistent.
But there's things like, for instance, if I remember correctly, didn't she wasn't there a Mulder Scully baby that was involved, or did that disappear at the end of the show?
I think that was a dream you had.
Okay. She didn't have a baby at some point?
She was pregnant at one point. I don't think the baby was ever seen.
Okay, never had a baby in the show. Okay.
Well, apparently they're coming back to the show, aren't they? Like, for a smaller role?
I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea how they're doing this. You know, it's...
Mike, is Chris Carter, who was the showrunner and creator of the original X-Files, is he back for this, or did he sell the property?
He's back for this, and, you know, this is sort of like George Lucas. Is this a good thing or a bad thing that he's still involved? You know, not George Lucas in X-Files, obviously. I mean George Lucas in Lord of the Rings.
What?
But is it a good thing or a bad thing that Chris Carter's involved? Because a lot of people will say, you know, Chris Carter created it, but he never delivered what he was promising, sort of like Lost, you know, where, no, I know what we're doing all along. And then when you get to the last episode, it was like, no, I didn't have any clue. I'm sorry. I lied. I've been lying. We've been bullshitting you the whole time. There were never any answers. We never really believed we would get this far. We were just hoping to be canceled before we got caught. And that's kind of, you know, that happened with Battlestar Galactica. It happened with Lost, and it certainly happened before then with X-Files, where they were spinning plates just to keep the show going as long as possible. And now would be a good time to reveal everything, but we've been renewed for another season. Shit. Bees! Let's throw bees out there! Bees are tied in with the aliens.
Well, how could they not be?
Well, I don't know. Because then that gave us Jupiter Ascending. And, oh, anyway. It's like I said. So I'll be curious.
Mike doesn't want to believe.
Not the bees.
Bees. I'm covered in bees.
Bees.
Mike would like to believe. Mike would like to believe, but you know, believe but verify. So let's see what they got. Look, I'm gonna watch. I'm not stupid. Well, maybe I am, but. Maybe I correct myself. I will watch. I will hope. I will keep my fingers crossed. And I hope they shock and surprise me. But, you know, I kind of wish at this point maybe they would just
stop.
I don't know. I'd almost rather a complete break and reset. You know, if not a reset, but just follow something new with as little baggage as possible. As much as I love,
well, then they shouldn't call it X-Files.
Well, again, that's all, you know, gets back to it. That's sort of going back to when people said, well, if there's no Kirk and no Spock, they shouldn't call it Star Trek. Right. And well, could you have like an X-Files, the Next Generation? Could you follow that and maybe try to, you know,
well, that's fine then. Call it X-Files, the Next Generation. Don't call it X-Files.
Yeah. All right. And to be honest, I mean, you know, there's some lame, you know, insulting of the show in a sense, or harassing it, I guess. But we have to admit, in that 9 years of episodes, there probably was more good than bad, even if it wasn't wrapped
absolutely
up
as we had hoped.
There was more good than bad, but it was certainly front-loaded. And I liked a lot of some of the stuff they did later, but there was no question by the time they got to the last season, there were episodes that it was you already did this one. You already told this story. You're recycling this plot.
No, again, though, we know that and all that, and it, yeah, unfortunately, like a lot of shows, the longer you go, the worse it gets. However, we can still say that there was a good percentage that was fantastic television. And the thing is that now that they're coming back and bringing it back. You know, similar to like, you know, how the South African guy is playing it, wants to bring back Alien with Ripley. Maybe it's like you guys said, maybe they could reboot, call it X-Files, the Next Generation. And you don't need Ripley. You don't need Kirk. You don't need Scully. You can just go with new characters in the same organization within, you know, the federal government and so forth and so on that does super or paranormal or whatever.
However, if they do get Ripley and Kirk for X-Files, I'm there.
And no one's laughing. It was lame. But on a serious note...
Now I'm laughing.
and now on a serious note, didn't they reboot X-Files calling it Millennium?
Oh.
No, Millennium was
different.
Was a spinoff.
Yeah, but it was a spinoff, and it was basically Chris Carter, his new series, I guess, right?
Well, no, it ran concurrently, and it only lasted 2 seasons. So it followed X-Files, but it died long before X-Files did.
Okay, and was Carter part of that as well?
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure if he...
And same thing with The Lone Gunman, which didn't even last a full season.
Okay, interesting. Well, anyway, does anybody here know the
Muffin Man?
The date?
It lives in Dairy Lane.
The date?
Probably the date, next year.
Okay, oh, so when it's going to air? Yeah, I don't know. Okay.
So it's basically just being talked about and in pre-production with a go, basically.
Yeah, it's got to go. That's the news.
All right, very good. All right, so we'll have to just wait and see to see how it's going to turn out. Who is going to be in it? Is Scully and Mulder going to be the leads again, or are they just a supporting cast? Well, we'll find out, I guess, during the year sometime. Any other news, Mike? Or anybody else want to add anything about the X-Files?
I'm good.
All right. Any other news? Anyone?
I think.
All right. So, Eric, what have you seen lately that's genre-related or read-related that's genre-related that you want to let people know about?
Well, I'm into season 5 of Sons of Anarchy at this point.
Nice.
The show has its highs and lows. First 2 seasons kicked ass, then third season dipped a little bit, then came back in season 4, and then got a little stupid, and then came back again. And now the plot is pretty strong, but the problem at this point is that everybody in the show is an asshole. I'm having trouble rooting for anybody at this point. But it's a very well-made show, and definitely worth checking out.
What season are you in right now?
5.
Okay. Aren't you with Potter, the assistant district attorney?
Yeah. Something bad just happened to Pope. That'll give you an idea where I'm at.
Okay. All right. So, but it is tough because there's not many characters, you're absolutely right, that are sympathetic.
Right. Other than that, Phil posted in the Facebook group about the best genre movie of the year called Backcountry. So I went and watched it, and I disagree. It's a well-made movie, but I didn't find it particularly interesting except for 5 minutes in the middle. I've also watched, Zombievers. everybody needs to watch Zombievers. It's totally tongue-in-cheek. It's meant to be humorous, and it is very humorous, as exemplified by the theme song that they wrote for the movie, which is done in the lounge style. Zombievers. Go search YouTube. It's awesome.
Now, Eric, you mentioned a film... We just talked about it offline for a second. Faults as well, right?
Yes, Faults. I watched it seems like a forever ago that I watched that. I can't believe I haven't talked about it on the show already. But yeah, that's a movie about a girl who is in a cult, and her parents want to bring her back, so they hire somebody to, I guess, unbrainwash her. And it goes from there, and might not be exactly what you're expecting.
Yep, it stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead too as the girl, and a lot of people know her from a number of genre-related material. So
that's right.
Yep, and it's by the same producers as all the stuff that Simon Barrett and Adam Wingard and Ty West and all those guys. The producer, some sort of new director that I forget his name, but he's part of that crew, and so it has some of the same actors that you'd seen in some of these other films, and yeah, it's pretty good. I rented it on your recommendation.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other films besides Zombievers and Backcountry and Faults?
No. No, that's it.
All right, sounds good. Mike, what about yourself?
Not been watching much. I did go see I went to see Chappie yesterday.
Oh, all right. And how was that?
I went to see Chappie yesterday.
yeah.
You know what? I think it would be a nice little science fiction film.
I feel if coming. Yeah, there we go.
If Hugh Jackman's entire part in the film was removed. and there isn't anything particularly.
Is that because of him or the part?
It's because of the part.
Okay.
First of all, he's like the school bully in a robotics lab. Hmm. You know, he's walking around. He's walking around. Yeah, you saw it, right? Abe, you mentioned this last week.
Yep.
And
yeah, he's got this really tacky Australian accent. He runs around in shorts.
Yeah, he's dressed like Steve Irwin, like he just got out of the Outback. He's walking around the office with a gun on his hip.
Yeah, don't you?
No, they won't let me in New York.
Okay.
They wouldn't even let me draw a picture of a gun in school without getting a letter in my file because I traumatized some little child.
Why'd you do that anyway?
Yeah, well. Anyhow, the character just seems like a weird fit, and it's basically it's like RoboCop, and it's really what it is, and it would be less distracting if it wasn't so clearly RoboCop and Ed 209. And not that Ed 209 was necessarily that original a robot design to begin with, you know, that kind of chicken walker sort of thing. But it's, their little humanoid RoboCop is beating out my big giant hulking machine for its funding, and I'm upset about that, so I'm going to try to sabotage their program. Wow. You know, it's, I don't even understand how someone makes this thing as a police unit that is too large to fit down an alleyway, is armed like, you know, an entire battalion of militia. It just, it's, and it's painted in camouflage.
It's overkill.
In green camo. This is a military weapon you have built, dumbass. You're not building a police weapon. How exact? It's
hell. Even the guys they're showing it to even highlight that. They even say it's completely huge and ugly as hell.
Right, and it can't even apprehend a criminal. Right, there's no way for it to like grab somebody and put handcuffs on them.
I'm confused. Are we talking about Chappie or RoboCop?
Well, I'm talking about Chappie.
Okay.
And
it's called a moose. It's called the moose.
The moose, yeah. And its appendage for grabbing someone is basically a giant pair of shears.
Awesome.
So if it tries to grab somebody, it's just going to cut him in half. So it's a stupid design.
Actually, that sounds really efficient.
Well, for a military weapon. But here's the main thing: is that the story doesn't need it at all. Not at all. It's there so that they can have fireworks and double the budget in the last act. And that's it. Otherwise, you'd have an interesting little story about artificial intelligence. And, you know, you sort of have some religious themes that not so subtly touches on. But it would be a nice, quiet little science fiction film. But you need Hugh Jackman and the big monster bot to be able to turn it into a Hollywood product that they would push into theaters. And, you know, it just doesn't work on that end. I didn't mind it. I would say if you're interested in science fiction, give it a shot. I think it was much better than Elysium. A lot of people complained about the performances. I had some trouble with the accents because it's set in Johannesburg, but I didn't really have any issues with the performances per se. But, you know, it just has a hard time finding a consistent tone or a logical thread because of that little detour it has to take dealing with Hugh Jackman's character.
Speaking of this movie, the person that plays Chappie, that, you know, they use as the computer CGI. So you don't see him, the actor, but you see his movements because they put Chappie's robot on top of him. is played by Sholto Copley, who has done a number of films with the same director. But he's actually starring in a new comic book series called Powers that's coming to the PlayStation Network, which will be their first original programming. And I saw the ad for it on YouTube the other day, and it looked pretty interesting. I don't know if either or any of you guys have heard of this.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I know of it. I know Eddie Izzard is in it also.
Say that five times fast.
Yeah, I didn't plan that one out well. And I'm sure it's going to end up, because I don't have, I'm not on the PlayStation Network, but I'm sure it's going to end up in a, you know, some distribution deal sooner or later, sort of like House of Cards. You know, starts out at Netflix, and then now it's available on Amazon and a few other things for streaming. So,
yeah, Comcast, you can get House of Cards. You get the first episode free, and then you have to pay like $2.99 for every other episode for Comcast On Demand. And yeah, I wouldn't doubt Powers would be that way, and a few others. Anybody see, speaking of Amazon Network, Bosch yet?
Nope.
Nope.
I heard that's supposed to be pretty good. Also, speaking of House of Cards, one of our listeners, Michelle Barkley, instant messaged Eric privately saying that we should do an episode on House of Cards. I'm up for it, Michelle. So it's up to Eric and the rest
of the What are you doing? No, don't turn this around on me. I just told you it was up to you.
We just had this discussion, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm going to go through this, even though I know Phil's going to edit it out later. We just had this discussion before the podcast.
Yes, but actually, you're right, Eric. I apologize. We were waiting to see what Mike would decide.
Mike said Mike doesn't care. Mike would do it, but Mike needs more time to rewatch the first two seasons.
Mike needs to grow some balls, and Mike needs to stop referring to himself in the third person.
So Michelle Barkley, if you want us to do an episode on House of Cards, you have to pester Mike on the Facebook page to agree to do it. To
start. There you go.
There you go. So we'll see. We'll see, Mike. We'll see what happens. I think that's it there. Now, Mike, have you seen anything else of interest besides Chappie that you highly not recommend?
Yeah. Well, I don't highly not recommend Chappie. I would just say wait for Netflix. No, nothing that's standing out in my head that I can remember that's right. Genre related.
Very well. What about you, Abe?
Nothing of note worth mentioning, really.
All right, very well. For me, there's a couple of things I saw. Messiah of Evil, which is a film that was made back in, I think, 72, 73. It got remastered by Code Red and on Blu-ray, so I picked that up through the Code Red's website. And, the remaster is actually pretty good. It's a very artistic kind of zombie type of film. At the time, it didn't get much play, but oddly, actually, if you go to Wikipedia, they actually have a whole section of critical analysis of the film because it's very artsy-fartsy, so it has some interesting things that it says. So if you like that type of slow burn art house but zombie film, Messiah of Evil is a high recommend. You can buy the DVD, which is actually, I think, by Code Red as well, which is under, you know, like $10, and it's a pretty good film. You may want to see if it's even on Netflix. I have no idea, but high recommend. And then I bought through Amazon.
Sorry, I'm laughing because Mike just took this to the people.
Oh, okay. On Facebook group? I'll check it out.
Yes.
All right. I bought a film that I've been planning to get watch for a long time, and I never got to see it. It's called The Black Scorpion. It's a 1957 giant.
Oh, the Moss movie, yeah.
Yeah. And it has the special effects.
Stop motion by Willis O'Brien.
Exactly, the guy that did King Kong and I thought it was a pretty damn good film. The special effects are awesome, Abe. So have you seen this film?
No, I've seen clips of it. I've been wanting to. It looks pretty interesting. If I recall, the plot's about a race of giant scorpions that get loose from a cavern.
That's exactly right. Yeah. What happens is outside of Mexico City, there's a volcano that happens, and so a couple of geologists go to check it out, one from the U.S. and one from Mexico, and they discover that, as exactly what you said, that it opens up a cavern from quote-unquote prehistoric days or something that lets out these giant scorpions. And the special effects, once again, if you like Ray Harryhausen stuff, if you like King Kong, Willis O'Brien was the mentor for Ray Harryhausen. So if you like 1950s giant monster movies, sci-fi movies, or Godzilla films, this is a film you definitely want to check out. Unfortunately, it's fairly expensive on disc, $17.99 or $14.99, something like that. For an older film, usually older films are like $9 or $10. But I have to say the quality, it's not just a VCR to disc. It's actually like almost remastered. So it's a real good copy. And it's produced by Warner Brothers themselves. They own the rights to the film.
Or you can rent it from YouTube for $2.99.
Oh, okay, so it's on YouTube. That's cool. So, yeah, I don't know the quality of the YouTube versions of it, but, yeah, if you want to check it out there, definitely do so.
Well, when did YouTube start renting things? I always thought their stuff was free.
I was about to say, that's news to me.
Yeah, that is news. But you probably could rent it on Amazon, too. Who knows? But I do know this. The disc has a bunch of really cool special features, including a little documentary about Willis O'Brien with Ray Harryhausen, basically the narrator. And then it has test footage that Willis O'Brien has done, and it also has a clip from The Animal World, which is a documentary that Willis O'Brien and Ray Harryhausen worked on when Ray Harryhausen was actually his assistant. They took the 10-minute clip they did for that documentary of basically the world and animals, and they put it in here as an extra, as well as, of course, the trailers and things like that. So it's not just a movie, DVD, and nothing else. So if you like giant monster movies, definitely check it out, Black Scorpion. And then, of course, I saw Backcountry, as Eric discussed, and this film got a lot of rave reviews at the convention circuits back last year, and I liked it a lot. I know, Eric, you didn't think it was a great film, even though I think you did like it. But
it's well made. There's just no plot. That's all.
Yeah.
Do people go in the backwoods?
Yeah.
Does a bear try to eat them?
Yeah.
Yes.
That sounds like plot to me.
Yeah.
Okay, if you call that a plot.
Yeah,
it's all the plot I need.
And you would think for this film, like, it sounds a little contrived because, you know, they don't bring a map, they don't do this, they don't do that. Why did they go to this section? But there's a big spin in why all of it happens and how they get lost and stuff. And it seems like a legitimate thing, even if the character that made the choices did it without having a fallback plan if something bad happened.
I think the phrase you're looking for is he's an idiot.
Yeah, well, you know what? If he knew...
Yeah, he's an idiot. Yeah. There's no arguing this. He's an idiot.
Fair enough. So, but yeah, I would rent it. If folks want to see it, you can get it on iTunes or whatever. Backcountry, pretty good. Mike, you would probably like it. It's your type of film because you love those outdoor animal attack.
Yeah, it's one of about five films I've got lined up to watch next week.
Oh, there you go. What are the other five? Four, Mike.
Girl Walks Alone at Night, or something like that. It's the Iranian vampire film. Yep. Zombievers, Spring.
Yep. Was it false?
And there's some. What?
Was it false?
It was not false. So there's something else I can't remember. Oh, I just got the Adam Green film in.
Something to the marrow or something like that.
Yeah,
digging up the marrow.
Yeah, digging up the marrow.
Digging up the marrow. Not taking it up the marrow, right? That's
right. Okay. So, yeah, right now there's some high-profile genre films that have been released to VOD, and I'm right there with you, Mike. I haven't seen many of them yet. Anybody see Spring yet?
No, not yet. I'm planning on watching
it. Nope.
Yeah, I was going to watch that over the weekend, but instead I decided to watch Backcountry instead because I didn't want to see a supernatural film, and I think Spring is a supernatural film. But I
think, yeah, it's got a monster in it, and I admit that some small part of me hopes that it's like a evil Slinky brought to life.
Such a wonderful toy. It's such a wonderful toy.
A marvelous spring. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right, Mike. So, yeah, I'm probably going to... I'm probably going to watch it Sunday night, actually, and we'll see how it goes. All right, so any further things anybody wanted to bring up that maybe we missed or anyone? All right, well, I guess we can get into our topic. Eric, what does everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
All right, tonight we are recording a long overdue contest winner episode. We're going to be talking about the film that won one of our monthly polls, In the Mouth of Madness.
This one will drive you absolutely mad.
The riots began because the stores could not meet the demand of Sutter Kane's novel, In the Mouth of Madness.
Kane disappeared 2 months ago without a trace.
I'm the guy that writes horror books.
You can forget about Stephen King. Kane outsells them all. I need to know if he's alive or dead, and I need that book.
It's a setup. I just have to work out how it's set up.
Kane's writing has been known to have an effect on his readers.
See this? It's a map.
This whole thing has been staged.
You just get out.
This is not reality.
It's all happening for real, Trent.
Mike, you were the one that chose this, right?
Yes.
All right.
I'm just waiting. Now that we've revealed it's a contest winner, I'm waiting for all the technical problems to start.
and to be honest, I do have 15 to 20 minutes recorded of a pre-show what have you been watching and all that for this episode from like 6 months ago, and then we had a technical failure with Skype.
Oh, yeah. Wait, I forgot. This is a take two.
Yeah. So, well, Mike. Yeah, go on, Mike.
I do you remember what I said the last time we recorded this?
I haven't recorded it. I could add it on, but it's probably
no. That'll be a bonus feature on the DVD. The Lost Dark Discussions episode.
Yeah.
All right, I'm liking this.
No, I forgot. I totally, I blacked out the whole technical failure because I remembered I watched it once previously to record an episode. And there was a period of time last summer when Phil was very busy and they had cancel a couple of recordings. And I thought it was one of those, but I totally forgot the nightmare of the technical episode.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The horror.
Now, this basically was a contest where last year we did it, and we'll probably bring it up again once we finish recording. There's one more that we have to do. But what it is we were putting up a poll each month where each of us would choose two films that we probably want or think would be interesting for Dark Discussions. And so there would be a total of 8 films, and then people on the Facebook group Dark Discussions Podcast would be able to go on and vote for what film they would prefer us to do out of the 8. And in this case, I forget what the other 7 were, but like you had chosen this film, In the Mouth of Madness, John Carpenter's 1995 film, I think, or 85, I forget what
it was. Yeah. And this was one I'd been tempted, because we did several of these, and this was one I was tempted to do from the beginning. I think, like, originally I did maybe Prince of Darkness or whatever. But for me, this is the last so far, and I'm hoping it's a so far, the last of the really good John Carpenter films. Released in, was it, you said 95?
I think so, but I may be wrong.
94, according to IMDb.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is one of those movies that when people say, oh, but the 90s were awesome, it's like, yeah, but nobody remembers this movie. Nobody went to see it in theaters except for me. It died. And that's part of it, is that a lot of these movies people look back on fondly and remember well of the 90s horror movies. Nobody caught them in theaters. With, you know,
yeah,
you
had, this one barely broke even.
So, and this is part of where, because this came out, I think, the same year or within a year of Carpenter's remake of Village of the Damned, which had Mark Hamill, Christopher Reeve, and Kirstie Alley, and that was the acting powerhouse trio that he had, and it's that I thought was a pretty bad mess, but I thought this worked really well. And it's just, it's a surreal experience, and it's going to be, I think, hard to talk about in some ways, because it is just sort of, you have to immerse yourself in the story.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, it's a Lovecraftian story. I don't think that's too big of a spoiler. And it's got some of the same issues that any Lovecraftian anything has going on, is because if you actually read Lovecraft, he never really describes anything in concrete terms. He's just like, something so hideous it would drive you insane. Yeah, okay, but what does it look like? And
yeah, he would spend an entire paragraph not describing something.
Exactly. And so there's some of that in this movie as well.
But also, that's interesting too about Lovecraft stories, is that if you can get through the narration type of storytelling, because he doesn't have much dialogue, it's basically a narration type. The stories are fairly non. They're not like this film. In other words, this film is kind of dreamy and whatever, while everything that Lovecraft does fairly takes place in the real world.
Yeah, it's fairly procedural, I think, is what you're trying to get across.
Thank you. Yeah. So it is. It's a little odd, even though this is very Lovecraftian. It's its own distinct thing because of how it's done. Yeah.
Well, say it's with Lovecraft, it was everything's over and someone's telling us in flashback what happened, and usually like a journal entry or a diary entry or something. And that wasn't that unusual a writing technique then.
Right.
But it's more unusual now, where everything tends to be in first or third persons, but it's an inactive tense typically.
You know what I noticed
it's basically you living through the story that eventually Lovecraft would tell us. But there are elements, which is, you know, they got the guy who goes to investigate, you have eventually going mad, and the idea of the great old ones, these creatures emerging to destroy the world. Those are all really obvious Lovecraftian tropes.
Never mind the name, The Mouth of Madness is a play on.
Oh, then you throw in the superfluous stuff, the homages, in terms of not only the name of this story, but a lot of the Sutter Kane novels. You know, the fact that these are creatures with tentacles, which tentacles are big in the whole Lovecraftian Cthulhu mythos stuff.
And I'm pretty sure they pull some direct quotes as well.
Yeah, and they do name certain characters and things like that. This movie has a bunch of those Lovecraftian things. I could have prepared and had the whole list of them, but I didn't bother.
Because that would have taken effort.
Well, no, actually what it was this week is as you pretty much said for yourself, Eric, has been pretty busy. So
I'm not busting on you. I'm totally against effort.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. No, but seriously, usually I have been better prepared for things like this, but I wasn't able to get to watch the film until last night as a rewatch. Now, Eric, you were about to say something about the credits?
I was just saying that I noticed in the credits this time, because I left it running because I was doing something on the internet, this movie actually has Hayden Christensen in it.
Oh, that's interesting.
He plays the paper boy at the very end of the movie.
Oh, that's interesting, too.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah.
What about now, Abe?
Yeah.
What was your awareness of the film? Have you seen the film before? And
I had heard of it, but I never got around to watch it. I did see clips here and there, but never the whole thing until our first attempt at doing an episode on it before
the lost tapes of Dark.
Yep. Tragic, I know. And then, but that was my first time actually watching it. I've heard of most of Carpenter's other films, but I've always held the Thing, for example, as some of my all time favorites, and I never really got around to looking at his. I think this was part of the Apocalypse trilogy, actually.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, the Thing was also part of it, and there was Prince of Darkness.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I always wanted to try to find it, and I was kind of glad that we finally got around to doing so.
Now, my first experience, believe it or not, was Siskel and Ebert. When they were still doing their TV show, they actually...
Were they still doing that in 94?
Yes, they were. Yeah. They were still sucking down oxygen.
Yeah, I used to watch it every Sunday morning, and then when they moved it to evening, it depends on what area this. I think it was syndicated, so it depended where you lived. It was always a different time, no matter where you lived. So it wasn't like a regular television program because it was a syndication, I think. But I saw them review the film, and they showed the cut of the demon running down the hall and stuff. So it immediately got my attention. And, even back in those days, even though I had slowly switched over to more drama films, I still did like the sci-fi and creature feature films and stuff. But they did not like the film. I remember them saying it wasn't that good. They thought it was too short, for the amount of stuff they were trying to get in, because oddly the film's only about 90 minutes. And I think they said that it was too artsy-fartsy for what a horror fan would like. And I think that's probably why it may have bombed, but also I think that's what makes it a cult film today. But this is what – I'm just saying what they said.
No, I know.
And then I never bothered seeing it, though, because, again, this was 95. So I just waited until it came on disc or not disc, VHS tape or something, or HBO or whatever, and finally watched it. And that was my first experience of it. What about you, Eric?
I'm pretty sure I rented this on VHS.
Okay, all right. And Mike, what about you?
I saw it in theaters.
Oh, all right. So you saw it at the theaters. That's pretty cool. And now, Abe, for someone that didn't grow up with John Carpenter as a superstar, in other words, when you were born, he was already like the Beatles, to us, or, past. It was before we were born type of thing. What is your perspective of this film? And I guess, because, obviously you did say you thought The Thing was one of your favorite films and whatnot, but what was your perspective of this film? Because this is definitely a different type of film. And again, John Carpenter is, one of the old ones, in a sense, to you.
Yeah, what do you think, Abe, is the short version of that?
Okay. I think it's a pretty interesting little film. It's definitely on the cheesy side,
Yeah,
The effect, the effects don't really hold up as well as, The Thing does, for example. Like, you can definitely tell they're like claymation creatures and stuff.
Yeah, when Dan and I watched this, when we were going to record this originally, one of the comments he made is that this movie would be a prime candidate for a remake, because it's got some good ideas and the story's pretty cool, but the effects do not hold up.
No. But I do love the little, the sweet little love letter to Lovecraftian and mythology and stuff. I thought it had some interesting little twists. And I thought the action for the most part was pretty good. I mean, at times it got a little hammy. But I could definitely, see why it became a cult classic. Even if I didn't grow up with Carpenter as the big superstar he was known then, I could still see why people would appreciate the film, despite its troubled little stay in theaters.
Yep, no doubt. Now, Mike, you said you saw it at the theaters, so you were early 20s or mid-20s. What was your opinion back then? I mean, obviously, Carpenter, you had already thought he was one of the best because, you know, you saw The Thing at the theaters for crying out loud, and you know, you liked that film a lot and such.
Yeah, I really liked it then, and that was certainly at the time when, as a horror fan, things were thin in the theater, so you took what you could get. I in no way, shape, or form have I ever been a Carpenter Kool-Aid drinker, because, you know, like I mentioned, Village of the Damned I thought was awful, and I thought that when I saw it in the theaters too. I can't remember. I know why they came out pretty close to each other. I can't remember which was first, which was second. So, like I said, I just liked it. It's got issues because it was a low budget film. It feels like a low production value film. Not all the performances are that great, although it does have some solid casting in it. I think Sam Neill does a really good job for what he's been cast as. But yeah, and there are certain issues there. For me, it really comes down to how it's written and how it plays with the audience, and certain that, and there were just certain moments that stand out, and I think of like the guy chained to his wife. You know, certain just odd images that I liked. And yeah, some of it's a little predictable, some of it is I think I'll agree with Abe, some of it is definitely a little cheesy. And certainly that's one of the problems. If you want to go through all of John Carpenter's films, there can be a lot of cheese in them. I think that's the strength of The Thing, is that it is fairly cheese-free.
Yep.
Timeless
too.
And time, yeah. It's for me, you have the really for me The Thing, and you have Halloween stand head and shoulders above everything else Carpenter has done.
Oh, I'm throwing in Escape from New York too. That was fucking awesome.
No, I've got issues with that too, but that's another podcast for another day. So, you know, but it's also, let's be honest, we talk about Lovecraft. This is also a big steaming pile of Stephen King commentary too.
Yeah. Yes. Oh yeah. Big yep. time. Yeah.
Which partly dates it. And the funny thing is, it was dated when it came out, because what he was talking about with Stephen King would have been so much more appropriate about 6 years earlier.
Yeah, in the mid-80s, yeah.
This is sort of like someone coming out now, you know, with a movie complaining about The Matrix. You know, it's like, yeah, well, you missed.
Mike, if I could interject for a second, I think, you know what it is? It's funny that you bring that up, because even though it is Stephen King, and you're right, the 80s would have even been better as a commentary with this film. But at that time, that's when that mass market paperbacks of all these horror writers, basically Stephen King plus all of his wannabes and clones, were being published, and every big publishing house was grabbing anyone and anybody that had a horror novel. And so, you know, you would walk into a grocery store, and, you know, you would have your mass market romance novels like you do today. But back in those days, you had mass market horror books everywhere, similar to like you have mass market James Patterson.
Yeah, but even that was more, because that was something that still I think was bigger more towards the late 80s, and Stephen King particularly, because this wasn't just talking about mass horror novels in general. This was Sutter Kane is an obvious reference to Stephen King, you know, with, you know, his, the stories set in New Hampshire, as opposed to Maine. And Stephen King, of course, will admit to being heavily influenced in his ways by Lovecraft. So, but it's the idea that you have an author, you know, who is basically bigger than, you know, like as big as the Beatles back in the 60s, right? You know, it's,
It
was just absolutely everywhere, you know, and where you would walk into any store anywhere. I don't care if it was a Christian bookstore and you could see from a mile away the rack of books with Stephen King in big red letters on the cover.
Yeah, and all his, they did a great job with the design of the fake books in this movie because they all look like Stephen King books.
Yep.
They sure do. Yeah, they reminded me of Pet Sematary.
Yeah, I got that vibe too, actually.
Right, but the funny thing is, of course, at the time when this comes out in 94, well, it feels a little dated because we're 6 years out of date. 20 years later.
Well, it was actually.
That's not a big deal.
To correct it, it was filmed in 94, but it was actually released in theaters February 3rd, 1995.
Okay. So, but that's it. I mean, so that doesn't matter as much. And it feels like, again, just the style of way it's filmed and certainly the style of the clothing, you know, in the lighting, it feels like that sort of mid-90s film, which really not my favorite period of cinema. So it's like I just think it stands out as a good film. It's one of these things where while I watch it, though, I question, is this film served by the fact that it didn't have CGI? Now, not 94 CGI or 95 CGI, which would have been god-awful.
Right.
Like if we were to remake it now.
Right. We would have the demon in the hall would be a CGI monster probably.
Right. And but how much of the film, because of the way it plays, I think a lot of it benefits from not showing you a lot, from leaving a lot to the imagination.
Part of what I was referring to when I said it had some similarities with where Lovecraft writes, because it didn't show you everything.
Right, because they couldn't show you really what the monsters would look like.
Right.
The way, and because of what was capable, and do you really want them to? Well, I mean, you do want them to, but, you know, do you want them to? You know, would it ruin something?
Yeah, I see. Yeah, I understand.
I don't know. It's sort of like, you know, do you really want to see more of the shark in Jaws?
Right. No, I mean, that's fair. And that's the thing that, again, probably is partially why it has become a cult classic or a minor classic for at least genre fans anyway. Speaking of that, I guess we have to put it in context with Carpenter in a sense, and we all know Carpenter's career. It's a varied career from very good to very bad to some odd little films that have been mixed in to even award-winning films that oddly are somewhat forgotten, such as Starman and such. But where would you guys put this film in his canon? Mike, what about you?
The Thing, Halloween, Big Gap. I put this, Prince of Darkness, right up. About the same. I'd probably need to revisit Prince of Darkness if I want to split the hair. I'm not that big a fan of Escape from New York, although I recognize it's certainly got its fan base. I think
Christine.
You know what? I would say something like Christine in the Fog, and maybe even Vampires might be like just maybe one notch down from that. And then, you know, the ones like I'm not a fan of, Big Trouble in Little China. I've only seen once. I would need to see that again. I haven't seen Starman since like 1985. So I really can't judge that.
Oh, I forgot Starman was him.
So you're generally saying that it would be the second tier after Halloween, in your opinion, anyway. Halloween.
Yeah, but it is to me. It's a big gap, though. Even putting it at a second tier, it is a solid horror film. It is like I think it's a little bit above for me something like The Fog and Vampires. I think it's a little bit above those. Yeah. Not that the, and Christine. Not that those are bad films.
Okay, no, that's fair. What about you, Eric?
I probably like it a little bit better because I honestly didn't groove on Prince of Darkness that much. So I definitely put it above Prince of Darkness, but it definitely doesn't live up to The Thing or Halloween for sure.
All right. Yeah, for me, I'm a little different. I have to say that The Thing is my favorite by him, and then Escape from New York is just below it. And then Halloween, and then after that, there's a big gap that drops down to the Fog.
You know what, though? I think I'd put Starman ahead of it. I love Starman.
Yeah, that was a damn good film. But yeah, I would put it a little less than The Fog. Definitely better than Prince of Darkness. And Prince of Darkness was very dated, it feels, when I watched it last year. This one doesn't feel as dated. But the plot doesn't hold up to the top films that we just named, Starman, in my opinion, Escape from New York, Halloween, and The Thing. But it's still a good film. It's good, but there's just something about it that doesn't make it great like those other films. Stating Escape from New York is a great film, even though Mike says otherwise. Abe.
Hey, yeah. And I'm in a minority on that, so I concede.
Fair enough. Abe.
Yeah. The Thing in Halloween at the top, definitely. It definitely be, for me, be below Big Trouble in Little China, The Fog as well. I feel like it's maybe – I think I would tie it with Vampires because, I mean, there's things about that film I really liked, but things about that – by the same time, I was kind of iffy about it, just all the same. I got to revisit a few films like Assault on Precinct 13 and maybe give Christina another a watch. I mean, I like that movie too, but I still need to look at those one more time before I can really decide where they are on the list.
Oh, that's fair. Now, we were mentioning Stephen King, Lovecraft, all that. Eric, why don't you just give a little synopsis of this film, because I mean, if you can even do it.
Well, no, it's pretty straightforward until you watch it. The basic plot outline is that Sam Neill plays an insurance investigator, and at the beginning of the movie, he is assigned to check out the disappearance of a very famous author, Sutter Kane, who has disappeared. Because the insurance company thinks it's all a publicity stunt, and they want him to find him to prove that he's still around and that the insurance company shouldn't have to pay anything out. And then, once he starts his investigation, he starts to find that not all is as simple as he thinks it was.
Yeah, and the thing that's odd about it, too, is that no one knows where Sutter Kane lives. Except maybe his agent, and his agent won't give that information out.
Right. Now, I do want to say that there's an interesting – at the very beginning of this movie, the first thing you see is Sam Neill getting locked up in a crazy house, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to point out because there's – I mean, clearly Sutter Kane is a Stephen King stand-in, right?
Yep.
There's another Stephen King connection in this movie, which is that as when he gets locked up at the beginning of the movie – they start playing over the radio in the insane asylum, a Carpenter song, We've Only Just Begun. And that same song is used in the adaptation of the Stephen King short story 1408. The entity in room 1408 plays that song over and over again to torment John Cusack's character.
Well, I don't think that he knew that at the time he used it in the film.
No, I'm just saying there's another tie here.
No, well, what I love about, I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to bring
it
up.
And the people who made 1408 may have done that on purpose.
Right. What I love about that is first is Sam Neill, it's like they play the music in the insane asylum and Sam Neill. First of all, We've Only Just Begun because we're at the end of the film, right? It's that classic. We're showing you the crazy person in the beginning of the beginning. And so it starts with We've Only Just Begun. So we're breaking the fourth wall.
Uh-huh.
By telling you that the story is only just beginning. But then you break the fourth wall again when he sort of, you know, sags to the floor, he's like, oh, not the Carpenters. And of course, it's a Carpenter film.
Yeah, right. it's all it sorts of fun.
And it also does have my favorite line in the film.
Yeah.
Which is, sorry about the balls.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
I don't know why, childish juvenile, but I still laughed. Because he kicks an orderly in the balls as he's being dragged into the insane asylum.
So either the people who made 1408 made that link on purpose, or there's a bunch of people out there that just really hate this song.
Well, let's talk about the asylum in general. So obviously this film is told in flashback then, right?
Yeah. Although not typical flashback.
Well, it's a little hard to say.
Well, let's rephrase it. What happens is
that
we have Sam Neill in the mental institute, and then after this scene, we have him beginning his investigation, right?
Right.
So,
by the way, I just want to mention there's when the inspector comes to interview him,
David, played by David Warner, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And the person goes to let him in the room and says he only asked for one thing, a single black crayon. And then they let him in the padded room where they're keeping him, and somehow one single black crayon has allowed him to draw crosses not only over all four walls of the room, but also himself and his pajamas.
I'm going to assume that that was one of those really big-ass black crayons you got when you were in kindergarten.
That had to have been a big crayon.
And I want to point out that the guy who lets him in was John Glover.
I don't know who that is.
You don't know him?
No.
Crap. I know he was on, like, the most recent thing. Right, the most recent thing I can think of he was in was that he would play Lex Luthor's father in the Smallville TV series, and was one of the best things in that. But he's a character actor who's been around for a really long time.
Okay.
And done a lot of different things. Because you have him, you have, Bernie Casey, who plays Sam Neill's boss or the person hiring him out. You get Charlton Heston. What the hell Charlton Heston is doing in a John Carpenter movie, I have no idea.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
I can only imagine...
Paycheck.
But I can only imagine this is John, because I don't think I'm telling any tales here when I say that John Carpenter is fairly left-wing in his politics, and Heston wasn't. So right. I'm going to imagine that, you know, maybe it's a John Carpenter joke that, you know, who is it that would employ the guy that brings the world to hell? Well, it would have to be the biggest Republican celebrity he could find.
But you know what? I could see them overlooking their political views for they're both fans of genre cinema.
Well, it could be. I don't know what it is. I just found it a little funny because Heston had basically retired by that point. He was just going around doing NRA stuff. Yeah. So it's just so weird in a film. You know, for him to just come in this, it's not quite a cameo, but it's not a whole lot more than that.
Yep. No, it's curious. I'm not sure how Carpenter got him to do it. Maybe they were buddies, someone knew someone because, you know, Hal Heston had been on three or four pretty big genre films in the 70s. And Carpenter was working in genre in the 70s, and so maybe they knew someone who knew someone. I don't know. That's a good question. But either way, he got in here. We didn't mention Jürgen Prochnow, who's a very well-known actor, especially in Europe, but he's done numerous English-language films as well. And people may know him from being the villain from Beverly Hills Cop. He was in that long, I think it was a TV movie originally, but Das Boot.
Das Boot.
Yeah, he was in that. People know who he is if they saw him, and he's a really good actor. And
Hayden Christensen.
Hayden Christensen, the woman behind the counter at the hotel, I forget her name, but she was a pretty big character.
No, she's recognizable. You recognize her when she shows up.
Yeah. So, you know, the cast, a fairly good rounded cast, as you said, Mike, at the beginning of this episode. But you know what, though? Carpenter, even though Deborah Hill was not, who's once married and then was also the producer of a lot of, and co-writer of a lot of Carpenter films, she wasn't involved in this, but still, Carpenter seems to always get good roles for all his movies. In other words, you know, like The Thing, the ensemble cast there, not any really big names at the time, except for maybe Kurt Russell, and even then, you could argue if was he even a big name at that time, and things. So he always is able to get the right people for roles, and you know, Sam Neill, no matter how, Mike, I know you always question him as an actor because you think he's, I think you said one.
Well, he's got a limited range, so that works fine as a character actor.
But here he actually plays the role pretty good. I mean, this is the type of role.
Oh yeah, I think this might be my favorite part from him.
Yeah. So though you know we got off track because we started naming character actors like Glover and such. The film was, as we were discussing, kind of sort of flashback. Is it right? I mean, kind of sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another trait from Lovecraft, right? It's almost like a narrative in a sense, except that, because, you know, here it is, Sam Neill, in theory, is narrating a story to the David Warner investigative character.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, so, there you go. What else? What do we want to discuss? How do we want to get into this? Let's talk about the Sutter Kane character in the books. Mike, you were mentioning how the mass market paperback, we were talking about it. But I want to start with you, Abe, since you didn't experience any of this.
There's that moment where they walk into a building and there's all these books in there. That was what we used to call a bookstore.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember those.
You may not remember those, but the way the Sutter Kane character is portrayed in bookstores, where how the books are all like they are, and what a mass market paperback, whatever. What was your experience of that in your life since you were born in the 90s?
Oh, I used to love going to old bookstores. There used to be one in Salem I was very fond of.
Salem, New Hampshire?
Yeah. Yep. There used to be, it was a nice little cramped little store, but it had stacks of books that were completely out of print. So you didn't know what you were going to find. And there was one on around where I lived. That's unfortunately long gone. You can find some used books there. I always love going to the used bookstore, as opposed to Barnes and Nobles or Borders, because it was always a treasure hunt. It kind of concerns me that we now books are mostly on electronics now. I don't know. I just it's something I really appreciate. Holding a book in my hand, you know, just having that physical copy on your hand. Plus, it doesn't run out of batteries on you.
Now, Mike, now you mentioned how the commentary of Stephen King and the 80s versus the 90s when this movie came out. Why don't you explain that to the what you meant, actually?
Well, Stephen King was I think it's fair to say that if Stephen King had run for Emperor of the Earth in, like, 1986, he probably would have won.
Right.
He was everywhere. And now, ironically, they were just starting to make his movies into films, and those were more miss probably than hit. They were never – they hadn't gotten, like, the Shawshank Redemptions or Misery or even The Mist.
This is how popular Stephen King was. They let him direct a movie, okay?
Yeah.
Most authors asked to direct a movie. The answer is like, what, are you kidding me? No, they let him do it. It wasn't a good idea, but they let him do it anyway because he was that popular.
And would you mind if I was completely high on cocaine the entire time?
that is true.
And he will admit, yeah, and that of course, was Maximum Overdrive. So yeah, and you would get these a lot. Look, a lot of them were middling films, but the books were massive bestsellers. They were everywhere. Everybody knew Stephen King. Everybody was reading Stephen King.
But to interject, you're absolutely right. Many of the movies were bad, and it used to be a running joke that any movie that's had Stephen King's based on the Stephen King, it was a joke. But when you go back now and you look, people forget there were some actually pretty good ones in the 80s, including Christine. Even though it's dated, it was considered a pretty good movie at the time.
Also, Christine wasn't bad.
Dead Zone was a fantastic film.
Dead Zone's always been one of those that, because it didn't get much reception when it was released, and a lot of people found it on cable. Creepshow still people maintain is one of the best anthology films ever made.
Also, The Shining, whether, you know,
right.
People on this podcast may have issues with it. It's considered a classic, and people love it. So he did.
I think Cujo is underrated, too. Cujo, yeah. I revisited Cujo, and it was better than I remembered.
Yeah, I've got to rewatch that because Dee Wallace is going to be at the Scares of Carecon this summer, and I want to rewatch it for that.
Yeah, and then don't forget the Salem's Lot, Toby Hooper.
Yeah. So he was absolutely massive, but like everything, no matter how awesome you are, you can't stay there.
Yeah.
Because people eventually just, you become old hat. Yeah. And that's not necessarily commentary on Stephen King, although I think you can argue any creative entity, you know, that their juice is a little limited, that they start repeating themselves or they stop finding ways to innovate because you only have so many fresh ideas.
Well, it's also a commentary on the nature of celebrity.
Right. Yeah. That's true.
No, I mean, that's all fair because, you know, I mean, Paul McCartney's still alive today, the Rolling Stones are still around today, Elton John, you know, on and on, and they can put out an album today, and some people will buy it, but it'll not ever be a bestseller, no matter how good it is, and even if it isn't good, you know, just for the fact that they have a name, it's going to be put out, and so, unlike back in the 60s or the 70s, you know, Stephen King's the same way, it's like, in the, you know, he had a heyday, and it may have passed. He still has fans. He still puts out some good stuff. It's just maybe not as the quality or what it was, or you know, the freshness, I guess you could say, as it was back in the day, maybe.
Right, but like I'm looking, like just a couple of days ago, director Alan Parker announced his retirement, and basically he said, "Look, a lot of directors don't still direct well when they get older." And I've mentioned this on the podcast before that this is what's remarkable about a guy like Stephen King. Oh, that's not Stephen King. Steven Spielberg. Or Marty Scorsese, is that they're still going, and I think they're about as good as you can expect. They're still above what many directors are doing. You know, where you look at, when was the last time anyone cared what Coppola released? You know, lot of directors just lose it, and they lose touch with either their storytelling ability, their editing, their pace, whatever it is, it just doesn't work anymore for them in the same way. So anyway, Stephen King, by the time maybe he got to 1990, I think is about when his stuff got, people had just settled in, and Stephen King was just going to be background noise for the rest of our lives. He was never going away, but he was never going to be at that, oh, you have to read the new Stephen King book.
Right.
Was never going to be there. And even when we've gotten good Stephen King books or popular ones, like, what was the last?
Desperation.
I was thinking more recent. What was the one that he released, like the JFK the, one a couple of years?
11-22-63
or Under the Dome, right, which were two of the better received ones he got. And you get, it's a good Stephen King book, and people go, oh, okay, I'll check it out. It's not that sort of, you know, like when Pet Sematary came out, or It came out.
By the way, that reminds me, when I first started doing this podcast, Phil was given the book 11-22-63 as a gift and said we were going to do an episode on that. Have you read that yet, Phil?
I have not, no.
You suck.
Right. So
wait a minute. There was
if MJ Preston's listened to this, now you understand what I'm talking about when it's taking me to read books. That one has been 2 years and I haven't read it yet. So,
I figure I bought Arcadia Event. I paid for it. I don't have to read it. That's.
So, you know, we got a general idea. We were talking about Stephen King and the mass market and how the fame is, you know, isn't as what it was in the 80s. Now, what else we want to discuss about this film? Because obviously there's a plot and we haven't really even gone over it. Basically, I guess it's Sam Neill is trying to find this Sutter King guy and.
Well, and let's throw out a spoiler alert here, but that being said, I don't think spoiling this is going to ruin the movie for anybody because it's really you can still have the experience.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean the reason we still want to throw the spoiler alert is because how he finds the location is kind of cool, mm-hmm. And you probably should watch the film to see how he does find out where Sutter Kane is quote unquote located. I think that was probably one of the coolest things with the
that was so, pretty yeah. clever. Yep.
Yeah. So all right. Well, so spoiler alert. Basically. What happens is, generally, he discovers that the covers of all his mass market paperbacks actually have the picture, some sort of hidden picture in it. And then when he puts all the covers together, like a puzzle, he finds out that the location, it shows the location of where something is. And assuming
it's Phil's house.
Yeah, it's basically somewhere in South Central New Hampshire area, maybe even central New Hampshire area, or basically the center of New England, in a sense, and the central New England is New Hampshire, this area of New Hampshire, and again, we got the Lovecraft, Stephen King, both New Englanders going on here, and the thing is that it's a giant map of New Hampshire, and that's what he comes to conclude is basically a hidden message of where you can find Sutter Kane.
But, of course, you also – this is one of those things that would be interesting in a modern retelling because now it would just be dumping into Google Maps, right, to find the location of the town.
Yeah,
But you still would have to cut out the covers, right?
Well, no, it would just come up on Google Maps. Right, because they use the argument, well, it's not on any maps that I know of. It's like, well, maybe it's on older maps.
There's two things. One is he has to put the covers together to find the longitude, latitude, and it's a big map of New Hampshire, and it shows a little dot in New Hampshire. And then when they go to, like you said, Mike, something that would be like Google Maps, they find out that the town doesn't exist or existed once but doesn't exist anymore. Nope.
Or Hobbs End, it doesn't exist on any maps. But of course, nowadays it would exist on it would guaranteed be exist on Google Maps or something.
Not if it doesn't exist.
That's the key.
Right.
It doesn't it exists
in another dimension.
There you go, supposedly.
Dun,
right.
Dun, dun.
Basically the story leads to Sam Neill and this woman who is she exactly? She works for the publisher, is it?
She was the editor for Sutter Kane, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
yeah, Sutter Kane's agent has gone crazy and started hacking people up on the streets of New York and, as a bonus, had two eyeballs or two pupils in his eyes.
Right.
Which was a neat little contact lens trick.
Yep.
And so they go to this Hobbs End town in New Hampshire, which oddly doesn't exist, and they can't even wiki it because wiki didn't exist back then to see if maybe it was a town that was incorporated in another town or whatever. Nope, they don't know. So they just go to the longitude latitude, and they get into this other dimension, I guess, right? I mean, that's...
Yep. Kind of basically, they're driving along in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden they go over a covered bridge and come through the other side, and it's daylight, and they're in Hobbs End. And Sam Neill had been asleep at the moment. So the lady who's driving, and while she went over the bridge, it changed from night to day. She's a little freaked out. He's just like, oh, I must have fallen asleep and slept all night. I'm glad we're here.
Yep. Yeah, it's a great little moment because they drive through and, you know, she's going through an REM video and he's completely oblivious. And suddenly there they are, right? Going through the magic tunnel. They're doing little Willy Wonka something. And
right.
It's like, oh. But what I like is just sort of the look on her face when he wakes up. He's like, oh, good, we're here, Styles. It's like, and she's just sort of like, you know.
Pretend you're on the bicycle.
You're driving.
Right.
Right. Yeah, and then there was a moment earlier where there was a kid on a bicycle who then turned into an old man on a bicycle who then got run over.
Was that earlier or is that later?
That was earlier.
Earlier.
Okay.
A couple of interesting things. There's a church they use in this scene, and I did some research on the church. It actually does exist. It's a Roman Catholic church created by Slovak immigrants to Ontario, so it was filmed in Ontario. The church has now been closed and is, I think, apartment buildings or something now, similar to a lot of churches when they can't maintain and whatnot. However, these churches...
Can I rent out the tower?
Don't know. You'd have to go and read up about it. But these type of churches exist everywhere up in... At least I can verify, is in Quebec. The French did it there, a lot of Catholic French up there. But this one happens to be in Ontario by Slovaks. And the thing is that this whole outer dimension we discover is basically Sutter Kane books, right? The tales are becoming
reality or something.
Yeah, something like that. Why don't you explain that?
It's really hard explaining where it's like, if I try to explain, I end up kind of revealing to the end before you even get to that point.
I guess it doesn't matter because.
Okay. Poor Sam Neill, who has, you know, has run-ins with dinosaurs and evil spaceships. It turns out that he is, a puppet, an actor. And hit one of his own stories. Everything that seems to happen has come from a source, an actual story. And
Sutter Kane is written.
Yeah, pretty much. And Sutter Kane wants him to follow those rules, that role, that performance. And no matter what the character he was playing Trent tries to do, he seems to be going with the flow. Willing or not.
So he thinks he has free will, but in reality it's all predestined.
Pretty much.
Now, Eric or Mike, you guys want to add to any of this?
Could argue, because there's that thing about free will. Like, for example, if I put in front of you a bowl of chocolate ice cream and a bowl of dog shit, and I told you to eat one of them, I know which one you're picking.
Sure.
Because of who you are, and it doesn't mean you don't have free will. So you could get into the argument that, you know, is it that he doesn't have free will, or is it just that he's doing what he's doing because of who he is and his character, his nature? Because he's a skeptic, he's a non-believer, and he's a cynic. Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit on the OCD thing, because I don't see how a normal person figures out that book cover puzzle.
Well, and Sutter Kane probably wrote him that way, because it was a great twist of irony for somebody who's that, I guess, addicted to being in control.
And having none,
To not be in control and be a puppet the whole time.
Well, but again, the question is, though, is did Sutter Kane write him? Or did he choose him?
That's not a question. Sutter Kane wrote him.
So, So it's right. So it's the idea, though, that as they're going through this, his agent, of course, has read all his books. Not his agent and his editor, and has read them probably repeatedly. And he's just gotten done reading all his books. So all these little details, for example, when they go into the hotel, you know, he said there should be a picture over there. He goes to look at the picture. He said the floorboard's loose, you know. And so all of these things are matching up with the details of this Castle Rock type town. You know, it's Castle Rock for Stephen King. It's Hobbs End for Sutter Kane, you know, that he's created where all the freaky shit happens.
Right, right. In Lovecraft, it's like Arkham or Dunwich and whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Eric said that he was written. Like, you implied that there's a possibility that he wasn't. He was picked. What is your opinion?
Well, I mean, it's the whole film is sort of playing with what is real, what isn't real, and how much of, you know, how much is, and how much of his reality is he creating, and how much is just that he's altering, and the, again, the whole thing is sort of a grand mind fuck, right? You know, which, mm-hmm. which when you get to the very, very end, you know, and him watching himself on the theater, you know, there isn't, it's all fictional narrative. So obviously everything is created. Again, calling back to breaking the fourth wall.
Unreliable narrator.
Right. With the Carpenter song though, right? It's only just begun. Oh no, the Carpenters, right? It's breaking the fourth wall. So it's a film that's sort of acknowledging it's a film that's acknowledging it's a story where characters don't know that there's characters in a story. So certainly Sam Neill's character was created, but it was created by John Carpenter, right? At the very least. Mm-hmm. Well, not Sam Neill. Not that I know of.
He was created by Michael DeLuca, the screenwriter.
Right. So, but this is sort of where to get into, and they do spend some time, like in the trip with, I wrote it down, with Stiles as they're heading up to New Hampshire, where he's refusing to believe that Sutter Kane has really disappeared, and she says something like it's not real from your point of view. Reality shares your point of view, and she says something. I'm just worried what happens if reality shares Sutter's point of view. Right. So it's again all about a matter of reality and perspective, and the whole thing is this sort of the Ouroboros, the snake sort of swallowing its own tail. What was the beginning? What was the end? What happened to get these events? Was Sutter Kane ever just a writer writing books? Was he always a pawn in a grand scheme? It's all about reality being very subjective.
And who wrote Cutter? Sutter Kane.
Ooh. Right.
Well, let's talk about that. Well, who is Sutter Kane? And I mean, obviously, in the non-supernatural world, he's just a writer of fantastic, or at least popular.
Horror stories.
Exactly. Horror. Well, so he's the Dean Koontz, Stephen King, basically. At the
time. Well, but he gives a speech in this movie. Basically implying that the reason that this is becoming reality is because so many people believe in it, because so many people have read the books, it's becoming reality.
Yeah, he's almost like a harbinger in a way.
Yeah, a harbinger. Yeah, sure.
That's the point.
Okay.
But in which place you're getting to the concept that reality is a manifestation of sort of a public unconsciousness, right? It's a
right. Uh-huh.
It's a reality is a collective illusion, and if you can get enough people to buy into your illusion, man. Right? If you can get enough people to buy into your illusion, this is really deep freshman year philosophy 101 shit,
right? I think, therefore, I am. All right. In fact, Sutter Kane even delivers a line at one point. I think, therefore, you are.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, for example, the movie Solaris, the sci-fi film, we've seen that where things are manifested from people's, I guess, thoughts. We've seen the movie Candyman, where Candyman exists simply because people believe they see him. And now, in this case, same type of thing, where people read the stories, therefore enough people read them, therefore they become real. And in this case, Mike, you made it even more interesting in the sense that you said that this is mass populations versus just individuals.
Right, but you even had this as sort of an old, you know, going back to religion. Do people believe because the gods are real, or are the gods real because people believe?
Sure, sure. Right. There's a tree make a sound when it falls in the woods.
Which comes first, the rooster or the chicken or the egg? The rooster.
So
going back to predestination, yes.
So then let me rephrase the question. Then what is why Sutter Kane comes up with this and says this, but was he part of a grander scheme too, or was he just sucked into the same thing that everybody else has been because they believe in his novels now?
Well, he was a writer, and his writing became so popular that he became a god, and he realized it.
Okay, I get it. Yeah, and that's actually an excellent thing, because that's similar to what, Mike, you were saying earlier, which is, you know, the cult of personality of, say, a famous person, in this case, Sutter Kane, in this case, a copy of the real Stephen King, in a sense. So...
Yeah, it reminds me, there was an old comic book series, and I think it's been revived recently, called Animal Man, which was taken by, he was a C-level DC Comics character, and a Scottish writer by the name of Grant Morrison got a hold of him, and wrote what's generally considered a really good series for when it was produced in the late 80s. And the culminating issue for his arc, which ended, I think it was issue 24, is Animal Man meets Grant Morrison. He becomes self-aware and realizes he's a character in a comic book and has an interview with and has a discussion with the writer in the comic book.
Okay.
Which is a weird thing, but it gets to that, you know, who is who and who is the writer and what happens.
Picture in a picture.
Right. So the same thing here is... The truth, movie, right? Sort of like Nightmare on Elm Street 7. But this is a case of, the truth is, everybody in this movie is a character in a movie.
Right.
Who are, for our entertainment purposes, believing that their character's in a book. Right, and it's...
My brain hurts.
but again, that's sort of the reality of it. But think about, and again, I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, when there was an argument after one of DC's various reboots of its superhero universe, and people arguing which stories really happened, which stories didn't really happen. Writer Peter David just kind of stood up and he said, "None of them really happen. They're stories. They're all made up." Right. You know, but this is the veneer. We get to this, and like, people get bothered if you cast the same actor in the same TV series for a different role, because wait a minute, he can't play the cop. He was the lawyer last season. You know, it's a TV show. It doesn't matter, right? You know, it's yeah. So you know, it's a matter of, it's tweaking with that concept again. That if you know this, people buy into believing something. Yeah, you know, God, you have people starting their own fucking Jedi religion.
Well, that's a really good point. Yeah, and then people are trying to learn, you know, Elvish from the Hobbit,
the Hall of the Rings, right? And stuff,
yeah. Or any of that other stuff.
Yeah, the Bible being printed in Klingon.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about the greater meaning then, because obviously it's just a movie, and it's a cool idea. By this, you know, by Carpenter. Carpenter probably read the script from Michael DeLuca and said, "Oh, this is a cool idea. Let's do it. This will be fun." But again, you know, you get your college professors that'll say, "Oh, no, this is symbolism and all this other stuff here too." What's the point of this movie then? Was it really just? Is it the artsy fartsy stuff that may have made people like Ebert and stuff saying, "Well, this ain't really the horror film that people want," or is it really supposed to be just entertainment, and it just didn't work as a commercial success?
Well, let me say this. I love Siskel and Ebert. I absolutely love Siskel and Ebert, even when I disagree with them. But the one thing I can tell you about Siskel and Ebert is that their finger was absolutely nowhere near where the pulse of the horror fan was, ever.
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
So whatever they think that this wasn't working because they were trying to second guess what a horror fan would have wanted – they had no clue, because that wasn't their gig, and that's fine. But they was, and I can say, and there are some clunky elements in this, some cheap elements and cheesy things. So if someone didn't like it, that's fine. But if you're a horror fan, I think there's a lot of stuff there. I think it's fun. I think it's sort of like Predestination. It's there to be something of a mind fuck, and it kind of kicks around these philosophy 101 ideas. You know, and does it for kicks. I don't think it takes itself all that seriously.
No.
Although, yeah, I could be wrong. Maybe John Carpenter takes himself too seriously, but I've never gotten that impression. I can't imagine somebody who made They Live takes themselves that seriously.
I was thinking that too, yeah, because he has his message in there, but he does it with a wink and a nod and a budget.
And a sledgehammer, yeah, etched up.
Yeah, and the budget, so he had an hour and a half versus a 2 hour movie it probably should have been. But
well, he does it, but he also spends 20 minutes in a brawl in an alleyway, you know, it's...
True. But let me ask you this. Well, actually, this isn't even a question. It's just a commentary since we were talking about Siskel and Ebert. It's kind of humorous, too, that especially for Ebert, because Ebert, you know, he was into the Russ Meyer and all the cult films and all that, and yet, so, you know, he's a genre fan. And yet he, like you said, he never really was into horror films, which was interesting because he was interested in every other, you know, genre, speculative fiction crap. And yet horror, for some reason, he was, you know, always so-so. It's kind of interesting. But to get back to what you were saying, Mike, no, you're absolutely right. It's, I guess you could look at it and say it's a quote-unquote mindfuck film. And that's what most people are probably looking at it as, even though I'm sure there's a handful of people out there that are going to say, oh, hold on, there's more here. There's more here. And there probably is more here, but it may not even matter. I don't know. Eric, give me your take.
It's a mindfuck film. Absolutely. And it's an entertaining one.
Abe, what about you? You seen the thing, you know, that's pretty much straightforward. I mean, whatever. This is completely out there. Have you ever read Lovecraft, and have you ever read Stephen King, and what's your opinion of what they are saying, or I should say, John Carpenter is saying?
I can't recall the last time I looked at a Lovecraftian story. I have to definitely agree that they are kind of difficult to read and very vague at times. With what Carpenter is trying to say, yeah, there's definitely a philosophical angle to it, you know, that sort of predestination, set of rules that you, man, you know, human beings being the puppets of some great force that they have no way of comprehending. I mean, that's the main theme within Lovecraftian horror, you know. These beings are so, you can't fight them. Every time you, just by looking at them, you go insane. Cause just the horror is just too much. And the fact that they are pulling the strings and numerous events, is actually kind of a scary thing. I mean, the idea that we have no free will is terrifying in and of itself.
No, and that's a good point, Abe, that you brought that up, because Sam Neill is in this film continuously fights. He, you know, tries to drive away, and when he drives away, he's suddenly back in the alley where he starts. He runs down the hall when a demon's chasing him, and the hall just continuously expands, and so on and so forth, and he can't get out of it. Now, anybody want to explain the ending? Because that's where I think people may have got lost, in a sense.
How?
Well,
I think if someone's trying to make sense of the film, they're not understanding the film is a mindfuck. And they're talking about a film that uses dream logic and is trying to destroy the walls of reality. It is not trying to set up a logical puzzle for which there is a reasonable solution.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Because, like, for example, the first time I watched it, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe, or whatever, when I bought the disc finally. I decided to say, you know, watch it, put it in, whatever. And then at the end, for some reason, I was just looking at the film as the typical unreliable narrator. So at the end, when supposedly there's a quote-unquote apocalypse, I was somehow thinking that maybe there isn't an apocalypse and he's just gone insane completely.
It could be that there is an apocalypse. It could be the people that have bought into that version of reality are living in an apocalypse, and the rest of us are just fine.
That's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
It's
similar to like that the muffins, where the people who ate the muffins, the people who didn't.
There you go.
Right. The books are metaphorical muffins. And it's a contact poison. No, it's the idea that the reality is subjective, and therefore some people will live in apocalypse and maybe some people won't. Or, you know, the question is, what happens when enough people perceive reality to be shit? Does that mean you get stuck living in the shitty reality?
I have.
Oh, nerds. Come on. We gotta cheer you up.
Jeez.
Oh, he's been betrayed by Apple. He has no place to go now.
Exactly. What do I do now?
Nowhere to go but down.
All right. So, anything else that we have to say about this film that anybody wanted to mention?
Okay. Sorry. Go, Mike.
No. I was just going to ask Mike if he was glad to pick this, but I want you to say your thought first because I don't want you to forget it.
No, I was just going to say that the last shot of the movie is one of my favorites of all time. That's all.
All right, why don't you let the listeners know what it is and why you like it so much.
Basically, as this all ends up, he is unable to Samuel is unable to avoid being used as a puppet. He's basically forced by Sutter Kane's writing to deliver the manuscript of In the Mouth of Madness that drives everybody crazy and opens the rift to the other dimension to let the creatures through. So that happens. And that's when he gets locked up in the institution because he actually goes kills somebody. But then shit goes down, creatures invade and attack the institution. So he just kind of wanders out of his cell, and goes and finds a movie theater where In the Mouth of Madness is playing. So he walks into this theater and on the screen, he's watching all these scenes in the movie that we've already seen in the movie that we're watching. So it's a movie within a movie with a movie that we just watched. And he just starts laughing maniacally. That's the end of the movie. And I thought that was a great ending.
We've only just begun.
Right.
Sorry. Yep. And I'm glad actually you brought that up, Eric, because even though like he opens the rift and all the monsters and attack whatever, the budget, if it had been huge, they could have showed a lot of that.
Right.
And that's another reason why this film could be a nice one to remake. Again, you can get around it in this film by just saying, "Oh, we're through the perspective of Sam's
right.
character." So it's he wasn't there when these things happened. But it would have been kind of cool if they did expand it a little and if they had a bigger budget. So, Mike, are you glad you chose this film and it happened to obviously be the most popular film out of the eight films that we put up, or at least the most interesting for the list? I'm guessing it was probably the most popular. That's why it was chosen, not because it was one that they wanted us to.
Well, I had a feeling it might end up, because I know it's a film that's built up. I don't know if it's truly a cult following, but it's gained a lot of respect in the passing of the years. As not quite to the level The Thing has, but a lot of Carpenter's films picked up a stronger following on video and in the aftermarket. Certainly, The Thing did. And Prince of Darkness did, and this did. They Live did. It's all these. And Carpenter was always a man who seemed to appeal to the next generation rather than the people who are going to see movies at the time.
Right.
But I'm very happy. It's a fun movie. It's a movie I want people to watch. Again, you always want to say, keep your expectations in check because it isn't the most awesomest thing ever. But it's a fun little mindfuck film. And if you're in the mood for that, it's a fun watch. And for me, it's my favorite, Sam Neill performance, generally speaking. And it's got some great little moments. And my favorite color is blue.
Ah, that's true. What? That's a good, the blue in the, on the bus.
Oh, okay.
There was this on YouTube, I was looking it up. This is like when we first did it during the first attempt that failed to record this episode. I was looking up scenes on YouTube because I didn't want to rewatch the whole film. And there was the scene about the bus scene. And someone made a video where, you watch the first 3 minutes, it's normal. And then suddenly they cut where Sam Neill like swings his head in like frustration, and the woman next to him's eyes bop out, or you know, and they just played it over and over and over to some like funny music. I wish I could find that link. It was hilarious, but I don't know. I was pissed at the time because I wanted to watch the
actual scene.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But looking back, it was hilarious. The thing is yeah, if you like John Carpenter's films, you know, a lot of people like Escape from New York, The Thing, Halloween, you know, a couple others, Christine, people probably seen because, you know, they're fans of Stephen King and Starman, maybe because of Jeff Bridges or whatever. If you wanted people to say, oh, what about other films by Carpenter? I mean, I saw those films. Are there any other good ones? You know, people would probably say this film and The Fog and maybe a handful of others. So people, yeah, who haven't seen it probably should definitely check it out. The one thing that's sick about this whole thing, doing this episode, since it seems just like it was yesterday, the film is 20 years old.
Yeah.
Isn't that disgusting?
Yes.
which I want to go back to the Horror Etc. episode on remakes. And they had rules for remakes, and one of the rules for remakes is that it had to be at least 20 years old. And, well, yeah, there
it's
we are.
It's time.
It's time.
Yeah, no, that's true. 20 years old. Jesus, that's disgusting. But, oh, well. Now, Abe, what about you? Would you recommend this film to other people? Would you say, oh, if you like John Carpenter, you definitely got to see this film?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought, you know, especially since it's part of the trilogy. I mean, I don't know. It's, I would kind of lower expectations. You're not going to get a phenomenal film, but definitely an entertaining one. It's been stated, it's definitely something that could use a remake. But what is there is pretty solid. Sam Neill's performance is great. If you love Lovecraft, you'll definitely like this. Especially how absolutely bizarre it can get at times, which is an understatement. But it's definitely a recommendation.
Now, Abe, you mentioned the Apocalypse trilogy. This is an interesting thing because this film is a standalone film. It has nothing to do with any other film that Carpenter did. However, he had three films, The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and this film that I guess end with apocalypses. And so what happened is, anybody know how it came to be? Was it just some fan group that said, oh, these are the three apocalypse films, or was it Carpenter himself that said it? Anyone know?
No idea.
No idea. I have no – I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, did Carpenter say anything about it?
Don't know. That's the thing. I mean, it could have. He could have said it in passing somewhere. I don't know. Mike, what about you? Do you know? You haven't said anything about it.
That's because I'm Googling it now.
Oh, okay.
Googling.
Because I kind of got the sense. I don't remember where I first heard it. I kind of got the sense that Carpenter has referred to it as that, and I don't know if that seems like sort of
afterthought or. You think he was doing?
Yeah, it might have been more of an afterthought. I'm just reading. This is an article from the Verge, whatever that is. The casual glance, the films seem to have little in common, save for the director. Each, however, on closer inspection, and it's clear that there's a thread that runs throughout each picture. Each movie forces its characters to combat not only an invisible enemy, but an unseen one which may immune to the nature of what they believe to be reality. I seem to think they're stretching a little bit here.
they're built on the theme
of it's built on the theme of cosmic horror, but it's not saying really. It just says that he refers to it as that, but they don't have a reference because, you know, it's an internet article. Yeah,
it
I really
matter.
Don't.
Yeah, I guess
I don't know.
But one thing is that. They are the two things that are in common is that they're apocalyptic films or the beginning of the apocalypse, and they were both done by John. All three were done by John Carpenter. Otherwise, they are dissimilar, except for the fact that people have grouped them as apocalypse trilogy. But anyway, anybody that listens to the podcast that wants to let us know, maybe one of us will actually find a link and put it up on the Facebook page anyway, but that'll be good. Any further thoughts? Anybody else want to say anything else?
I also recommend this movie. I really enjoy it. I bought it on Blu-ray when we decided to do an episode on it because I like it enough that I'll probably watch it again.
Eric, since you bought the Blu-ray, this is an excellent question because I'm the type of person that sometimes likes to upgrade. For example, Messiah of Evil I have on disc, a crappy copy where they took a VH tape and they just made a copy and released it. And then I bought the remastered DVD. But then I bought the Blu-ray just a couple days ago. And because, you know, for the extras and the better quality and whatever, what does the Blu-ray for this film, is it, who, what company did it? Does it have
I don't know who did it, but they clearly didn't put much effort into doing any type of remastering or anything like that. It's basically just transfer the DVD, and it's got the same suck-ass commentary on it, so.
Okay, so, oh, the commentary's not really that good?
Oh, God, no, like, I groove on commentaries. It's like my favorite thing since the invention of DVDs, but this one is awful.
Really
it's
bad.
It's John Carpenter and the guy that did the lighting on this movie, and the commentary is basically John Carpenter saying, "Hey, why don't you talk about how you lit this scene?" And the guy going, "Oh, well, you see, we had this rack of lights over here that were shining off the red wall to give it kind of a glow, and blah, 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 blah." And that's the entire fucking commentary.
Oh.
Well,
God.
I imagine if you're into lighting.
Yeah, if you're planning on going into lighting, absolutely listen to the commentary. But otherwise, you could skip it.
Right, because you were obviously hoping it would talk about the symbolisms and what he was trying to get at.
There's some sort of reference to the plot or what happened when they were filming it or something like yeah, anything but the lighting. I could really care less about the lighting.
No, it still sounds better than Freakin's Exorcist commentary.
Oh yeah, well, I don't think Freakin's commentaries are that bad, but I know what you're talking about, Mike.
Well, that one was literally just telling you what was on screen.
Right, right. Now, let me say this: it's unfortunate that this Blu-ray, it's probably because it's still owned by Universal, Warner Brothers, or whoever put out the film. Let me just verify this here. It is a. I don't even know who put it out, to be honest. Doesn't even say. But New Line Cinema. Okay, there you go. So that's probably now owned by the catalog at MGM. Who knows? But either way, it has not landed up in the hands of Code Red or Screen Factory or someone like that who could take it and you know throw up all the cool extras, I guess, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, oh well. It is what it is. I mean, I actually bought the Thing comment Blu-ray about a month ago, and they didn't even port all the you know the extras. So I was like, well, that's okay. I guess I'll keep both, you know. But so what? So maybe
I mean, it's not a horrible Blu-ray. It looks fine,
yeah.
But it's not any type of special presentation.
And to be honest, you never know. It could land up in someone like Screen Factory or whatever because, I mean, Screen Factory just released The Fog, right?
Uh-huh.
Last year. They were about to release Escape from New York in about a month or two, remastered with all new extras and all this other stuff.
And they did Assault on Precinct 13, and they did Prince of Darkness.
If Screen Factory did an edition of this with a commentary by Sam Neill, I would be all in.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool.
Or how about the writer?
Yeah.
That too.
Mike, so do you have the other Scream Factory ones?
I have I think I have Prince of Darkness, Assault on Precinct 13, I think are the two that I have right now.
I got They Live. That's pretty cool.
Okay, yeah. That's right, because They Live was by a Screen Factory. They picked it up too. So yeah, this one may eventually be picked up. You never know if they get the rights. One thing about the screenwriter, which is interesting, Michael DeLuca, it says here he's been nominated for 3 Academy Awards.
Really?
Yeah, so he's not just some, you know, nobody. His filmography, let's see what he did. don't know, but it appears that he did a lot of producing more than even writing, to be honest. He produced Seven. He produced Boogie Nights. He produced A Magnolia. These films, that's where he probably got his nominations, probably not even for writing, probably for producing, is what I'm guessing.
Right. And certainly not for making horror movies.
Yeah, you're right, exactly. Forget horror movies and Academy Awards. All right, so that's good. That was, I think, our first focus on any John Carpenter film.
Didn't you and Mike do a John Carpenter episode at the beginning?
It was me and Gordon. He was an old co-host for the show way back in the early, when we were doing, 40 or less, episodes 40.
Gotcha. Early. Okay.
And he and me did a John Carpenter retrospective.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, but as a group, Dark Discussions has never done a Carpenter film specifically.
We seriously haven't talked about The Thing.
No.
What the fuck, dude? How did you let that happen?
Really?
That's one of those things you're supposed to do on episode 200, maybe.
Well, yeah, then okay, that's the plan.
All right, here you go.
The Thing, episode 200 then.
That's right. Either way, this is the first one anyway, so there you go. All right, I guess we can wrap it up. So, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about In the Mouth of Madness. Tune in next week when whatever we talk about is what you'll be doing.
We've only just begun to live. White lace and promises. A kiss for luck and we're on our way.
We've only begun.
Just begun.